You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 140, and this is Chris Webster, which means we are talking about something cool. And today we're talking about a rock art panel from the Petrified National Forest in Arizona. So check your show notes, look at the panel, follow along with us, and see what you can interpret. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. This is Chris Webster. And if you're hearing my name again, that means that it's just Alan and I, and we are having some fun together, and we're going to talk about some rock art panels. Alan, how's it going today?
You know, it's going very well. And I guess we got a lot of positive feedback when we took some time and reflection and began to deconstruct some of the rock art panels that you're with. And I guess that surprised me.
Yeah, no, people seem to like that. We did get some good feedback, so, and I enjoy it. It's a fun thing to do, and you never know, because rock art, it's so difficult to interpret them, right? I mean, there are some things that we can get out of them that seem obvious, but then, you know, really it comes down to, I mean, the person that created it and what they were going through and just their cultural circumstances. And it's something we may never know fully the true answers to, but there are some things that we can look at and tell.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly. As scientists, we don't deal in facts. We deal in working hypotheses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see the interpretation of these panels as just that.
Yeah.
It may be our best guess, but it's an educated guess, and it's based on both linguistics, language. It's based on ethnographic data. It's based on a review of forager theology worldwide, meaning hunters and gatherers and how they view their world and what images and how they particularly perceive or transform their levels of communication in this way.
Yeah, that's right.
These were the storybooks for Native people. And I think I'm standing on fairly solid ground if I say that Native people that would pass these images would know instantly, in a heartbeat, for the most part, what they were telling them, because they're involved with indexical animals, their visual shorthand, their mnemonics. And so that all sort of figures into thinking about when we go to church, right? And we look at those stained glass windows that only have images on them. And preliterate people, you know, just people who, before they really taught people in school, understood that. They viewed those images, they understood exactly what they were communicating. How's that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got possibly a couple panels today to talk about. Look down at your show notes if you want to follow along, because it's going to be really handy. If you're driving or doing something else, then look later. maybe listen to this episode later. But if you can, look down at your show notes. Now, if you're on a device that won't show you the images, then just go. You can probably click through to the podcast page on the Archaeology Podcast Network where the actual images are, or just go to ArchPodNet, that's ArchPodNet, or Archaeology Podcast Network if you like to type out long things, but archpodnet.com/rockart/140, and you will see the images.
So the first one, and you can, why don't you introduce that first one just from someone who doesn't have any knowledge? That'd be fantastic. Go ahead.
Yeah, because there's literally no information on this whatsoever. You just sent me this email with this image.
Exactly.
Yeah, it looks like almost some sort of, there's a kind of a patina on it, and it's been etched, and there's a lot of damage on the rock art face as well. But I see animals, I see human type figurines, and I see shapes, and there's something off to the left that I cannot work out what the heck that is. I don't know even what I'm looking at, to be honest with you. And then some other kind of shapes, and almost a, well, there's a Koso sheep figure in the top right hand corner with kind of above the human looking figure with big old horns. It almost looks like a Cocopelli type of thing, but I highly doubt that in that area. But either way, that's what I'm looking at here. So where is this? First off, what's going on here?
So first of all, I decided to stretch my imagination and employ a panel that's outside of California. Oh. It's called the Butte Petroglyph Site. It's at Petrified National Forest, and it's in the great state of Arizona. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, part of the reason I chose this panel is it's been employed multiple times in a variety of articles, published articles, one in American Antiquity that I'm quite familiar with, but others in probably rock art scholarship along those lines. And they've had a lot to say about this particular panel and others that have a similar theme. So the biggest feature, the biggest element on this is an animal-human figure. And the animal-human figure has hands upward towards the heavens. The feet are splayed and end in the almost triangular elements. There's a dot, a very large dot, on each side of the figure. And if you look carefully, the classic and really very transparent element that grabs one's attention, if you're familiar with this, is what's called pendant labias, which are a distinctive feature which guarantees or irrefutably calls this particular figure a female of the female sex.
Right.
Now, there are figures like this all over the American Southwest. And besides that, those two large dots are very interesting. And I had a hard time trying to understand those for the longest time. And as I drilled down into the literature on renditions of females all over the world in supernatural, symbolic, and religious metaphor, they always have those two dots there, dots on either side. Yes. And those dual dots represent either the flaps of the labia or the breasts, and they trigger one to know this, in fact, is a female being. That's what it's communicating.
Okay. Now, that's interesting.
This particular female being is a classic rendition of a very prominent and central figure in the cosmology of indigenous people worldwide.
Okay.
Now I think that's quite a lot to say, right, Alan? That seems like a rather bold statement, right? Well, believe it or not, I have a publication, an article, a chapter in a book, which is a synthesis of discussions about this creature all over the world.
Really?
Yes. In Peru, in South America, in the American Southwest, out at the Torres Straits, in Antarctica, on and on and on and on, all over the world. Can you possibly guess what this figure is, counselor?
I mean, I don't know the name. No, I don't.
Okay. So it's called either the master or the mistress of animals.
Okay.
And that's what it is. There is typically in an infinite number of cultures worldwide, a particular being that is entrusted with the responsibility of taking the spirits of the slayed animals and returning them to the terrestrial sphere so that they can be hunted again by the native people. And if you talk to these native people, it's rather interesting because you can talk to them about the particular aspects. Say, well, it doesn't seem like there's as many animals these days. Have you been over hunting them? And they'll laugh at you. They'll say, that's ridiculous. They're immortal. These game animals are immortal. The mistress of the animals, you know, resurrects them each season and they're back again. The only reason there might be fewer of them is our magic isn't as powerful. And, you know, the number of shamans and medicine persons we have these days are quite few compared to what we had in the past. So when you kind of look at or view Native people as sort of ecologists, yes, they have a strong ecological nature and they have an ecological ceremonial or religious understanding of the universe and the terrestrial, you know, earth. Yeah. But their concept regarding the regeneration of these animals is flawed. It doesn't really happen that way. And in fact, scholars, anthropologists, archaeologists, probably even Native people, have demonstrated that it is indeed possible to overhunt and reduce the numbers of animals to a point where that they're no longer a viable population. Are you familiar with those sorts of studies?
Yeah, Chris? A little bit. Yeah, somewhat. We talked a little bit about that on the show, I believe.
We have. Yeah. When I began thinking about that, I thought that was rather silly. I said, How could a Native person with this rather simple technology have in any way, shape, or form hunted out or reduced a animal population to the point of nearly decimating it or creating numbers so low that they were no longer a viable target?
Yeah.
But, you know, my colleagues have studied this, and this happens again and again and again in archaeological studies where they found that even with things such as anadromous fish, shellfish, sea mammals, artiodactyls, there is strong evidence archaeologically that at certain times these targeted beings, these targeted, you know, animals were reduced to such a great fashion that they were no longer acceptable as the kinds of, you know, subsistence targets that would be useful for the Native people. This happened in the American Southwest with deer, I believe, and some others too believe that this happened to the bighorn sheep in the Coso Range. Bill Hildebrandt has demonstrated that that particular phenomenon occurred along the coast of California for certain key sea mammals. And we know from looking at the shell middens, believe it or not, that those Haliotis, those abalones, were so excessively harvested that the red abs vanished and all we had was black abs. And then the black abs came through and the red abs came back. You can see it. You can see it archaeologically.
Okay.
So, yeah. So there's that story. So we have this mistress of animals figure here. What the heck are all those other items, Alan? What do you think they are?
Well, that sounds like a really great place to take a break, and we'll talk about those guys on the other side. Back in a minute.
See you in the flip-flop game. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're back with the Rock Art Podcast, episode 140. This is Chris Webster, and I'm talking with Alan here on this panel. And we're still talking about this first panel, this big, wide, darker panel here, the one that's an actual photograph. And, you know, we're going to talk about some of the animals now. And I say, my eye keeps being drawn to one of these here, and it might even just be, I don't know what's going on, to be honest with you, because I, without actually seeing the panel with your own two eyes, I'm not really sure if what I'm seeing is real. But to the two figures to the left of the mistress of the animals there, there looks to be an animal with no front legs, but it looks like one of the front legs is about a few inches below it, almost like the front leg fell off and is falling down the rock face. Is that what that
exactly
is? Or is that just...
Yes,
okay.
I think that's just down to the actual figure or an incomplete figure. But yeah, there are at least two bighorn sheep here. One's above the head of the animal mistress, and one is to the her left.
What about far up to the right on that other rock face?
And far up to the right, I don't see anything there that would be. Oh, yeah. No, you're right. There is another one. Woo! Yeah, I didn't even notice that one. So there's at least three. But I've always focused in on this, you know, this particular panel. And ad nauseum, you know, in terms of my articles that I published on reproductive symbolism and all the rest, what do the bighorn sheep have? They have two things that I guess I'm known for in terms of the archaeological literature. Do you notice what they are?
Well, the tails.
Yes. Are those tails up in the air or what?
I see at least one tail up in the air. I'm not sure the others even have tails or they're down.
Here's one that's up, you know, the one overhead is up in the air and twisted. Sure. And then the one to the left is definitely up in the air. And if you note, it looks like some sort of I call it a spirit arrow, is intersecting with the nether region of that animal. And that occurs totally. And that is also very characteristic. So these are cross-culturally, I understand, even talking to people who have interviewed rock art scholars from all over the world, including the Middle East, and even back up to, the Altai in Siberia. This is a similar phenomenon. This tail up in the air is of course, open for reproduction. It's a particular habit or behavior of the ewe when they're signaling for the male ram to copulate with them. And that arrow is, of course, focused on the nether or reproductive regions and showing sort of an intersection between arrows and their fertility signs. They're signs of when the arrows pierce the ground, they're piercing Mother Earth. They're called lightning arrows. The word for arrow is the same word as penis in Uto-Aztecan, and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't need to go there so much. The funny thing is that I learned from my colleague is about those four images that are on the extreme left.
Yeah.
Those are feet, F-E-E-T, feet. And you notice those overgrown toes on them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, cross-culturally, all over the world, feet have to do with reproduction. Even in the Bible, in a chapter where it talked about a consort, a woman sleeping with a man and having relations, they specifically state that she spent the night at his feet. That's the way they describe it. And feet and their symbolism have to do with fertility, reproduction, increase ceremonies, etc., etc. You would find that native people are not as, how would you put it, not as prudish as we are. And this isn't a pornographic, you know, sort of picture. It's just a way of speaking to the cosmos and to the creator and also to the animal mistress, asking or placating or wishing that they would provide abundance and supply and replenish the animals and provide rain and, you know, allow them to live and be safe and healthy. It's a visual prayer. That's the way I try to explain it. And there is other indications of that theme. So for instance, right above the left arm of the animal mistress is a Cocopelli figure with a flute. You see the flute in his hands? Exactly. Yeah. And Cocopelli, of course, is a very classic symbol of reproduction and fertility and et cetera, et cetera. And it has a very interesting background. It has to do with, you know, using the flute as sort of a metaphor, an analog for the human penis. It's just shown in that way as a means of sort of, again, the visual shorthand and something that would then become a memory and a hallmark of that civilization, of that group. And they would remember who that figure is and what that represents.
Yeah, when I was first looking at this, I mean, I saw at this point, I don't know if we're even going to get to the other image, so yeah. It may not be in your show notes. But when I saw both images, and the other one actually is an image from a book, and it says it's from the Coso Ranch, so I saw that in the caption. I kind of just assumed, you know, you've done a lot of work over there, and I saw some of the sheep here, and I thought maybe this was also from the Coso Ranch. But then when you asked me to first look at this, I thought I saw a Cocopelli-like figure, not something you see in the Coso Ranch. And I was like, well, maybe that's just something else. But now I'm glad to know that I was a little bit right.
Yeah, so you're on the money, Doc. On the money, Doc.
Yeah. The feet, to get back to those images on the left, I didn't see those as feet. And I think it was maybe the element in between the feet, the thing in the middle that almost looks like a shovel or something like that, that was kind of throwing me off.
It's a preopic or erect penis. That's what those are.
Yeah, you can see it now too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I hesitate to sort of use some of this, you know, physiological analogs, but that's what they are.
I mean, it is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, without seeing it as feet, I almost thought, you know, the other one was upside down in this interpretation, the top one, but the bottom one, it almost looked like clothing, like a wrap, like it would go over your shoulders almost, you know, like some sort of like hanging thing. That's almost what I thought they were almost going for, almost because maybe I thought that because of the figure on the right, the mistress of animals, looked like she could wear it because she's got square arms.
James Potter did a very famous article in American Antiquity on hunting symbolism and uses this particular image as a part of his landscape context and talking about this. In my next magnum opus that I'm writing, I have a figure that shows maybe half a dozen or so of these southwestern elements that have these dual dots.
I'm just curious because something I also noticed on the bottom image of the feet, there's two of them. The bottom image on the right side of that, there's what looks like possibly a couple arrows and a bow. But on the top image of the feet, it's inverse of that. And on the other side, if you were to inverse this, there's another almost really hard to see bow and arrow on the left side of that.
Yes.
Bow and two arrows. I wonder if these are always drawn with those 2 feet, the bow and arrows, two arrows, like what that actually means. The arrows are on the wrong side of the bow there. But
they're showing the binary nature of life. If you look at Udo-Aztecan and if you look at... The nature of this indigenous cosmology, theology, symbolic metaphor. We're talking about a way of thinking that enjoys or employs the nature of life and its binary nature. We're talking about hunting, which comes with death. We're looking at life, which comes with vibrancy and movement and water. So in all of these pictures and all of these panels, you'll see an emphasis on night and day, day and night. You'll see panels that relate back like triptychs. You'll see a mother and daughter sheep. And then right below it, you'll have an upside down sheep with it impaled with a spear, life and death.
Yeah.
To them, it was a tremendous cycle, and it wasn't something to be, I don't know, afraid of, but something to at least recognize and capture and include. It's something that, it's the nature of the cosmos. And They do not see a difference between, you know, fulfilling the nature of growing and dying. And that is, in fact, part and parcel of the way it's called a biform. It has to do with, you know, sort of assimilating the spirit, life, generation, development, decline, death. These are cyclic. And there's this mysterious theme of regeneration and the miracle of rebirth. And I closed one of my chapters, one of my recent publications. Metaphorically, a seed dies after being planted. From that death, life sprouts anew. The seed spirit becomes embodied with the ethereal energy of the invisible life force embedded with all things. The seed is, in a sense, resurrected. And that's from Markham and Markham, who studied sort of Judo-Aztecan theology and wrote extensively on it. So.
Okay. Well, with that, sounds like another good place for a break. So let's do that.
Shall
come up on the other side and wrap this up. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 140. So that was awesome. Again, if you didn't get a chance to really follow along with us, just, you know, listen to this episode again and check out arcpodnet.com/rockart/140. And you can see the image, you can download it, you can pull it up on your computer and follow along with us, see what your own interpretations say and see, what you come up with. So I thought for this last segment, we would just, you know, see what's up with Alan, because we haven't really done that in a while. And, you know, you're always into so many different things, you know, just like people in this field, we're never just doing one thing and it's always like a whole bunch of little things. And it's just, you know, what are you doing these days? What are you into right now?
Well, as I've always said, you know, life is an adventure and you just continue. And I guess I always say that life is an adventure. It's an e-ticket ride for those who understand the 60s and went to Disneyland and went on the Matterhorn. I'm finishing up the largest project of my career. It's going to be done in the next, I'd say, 30 to 60 days. And it's a $7-8 million project where we had to look at in Oregon a mountain that had been on fire and tens of thousands of trees were burned to the ground. And so those had to be hauled out because they could have started a fire again when they fell and landed on the road or on a power line. So they were picked up, dragged out either by truck, but then also by helicopter. They were picked up and appropriately ensconced. What we got to do was to see literally, you know, 100,000 acres of ground and then see what was on the ground, because there in Oregon, as you're well aware, you don't get to see the ground very often.
Right.
covered with trees and vegetation, and they get 60 inches of rain there. 60 inches of rain. Can you imagine? So anyways, here was the ground. It was denuded. And there were 100 archaeological sites. And most of those were fully prehistoric. And what we found was 17,000 years worth of prehistory. 17,000, I know that sounds excessive. But here we are in the Pacific Northwest, where they're now demonstrating that they have 15, 16, perhaps even 20,000 years of prehistory buried and there for the offing. Mm-hmm. So it was remarkable to see the quantity of temporally sensitive projectile points. We saw a fabulous number of wide stem points that looked like borax, like wide stem, that were all made of some non-cryptocrystalline material and were ground on their edges. So it seemed as though it was typical or sort of a continuous thread from the earlier grinding of fluted points, you know, from the classic Clovis realm. Yeah. And they did find such points in Oregon dating back to about 11,500 years ago, minimum. So we had a chance to date source-specific temperature-adjusted obsidian hydration dating with some of the experts in the field. Absolutely cutting-edge stuff. We had hundreds of readings on the volcanic glass, which was relatively ubiquitous. And so that was a phenomenal project. We learned a lot, and we have a multi-thousand page report.
Wow.
I'm doing, several compliance projects where I help individuals who needed to glean CEQA clearance for their projects. And some of those have been rather complicated, but those that I haven't really had a chance to do yet. They needed test excavations. One was on an archaeological site and other things along those lines. So that's been interesting. And had to work closely with Native Americans in terms of monitoring. And also we found human remains. So that harkened back to using those tools and techniques that we always have for identifying with forensic anthropologists the nature of those remains and dealing with the repatriation of them through the Native American individuals that were ethnically tied to this particular area. It was in Napomo on the coast of California. So there was that. I'm finishing, or at least working on two other books that one is on sort of the nature of indigenous conceptualization of their universe and thinking about how they relate and how they've been scientifically tested vis-a-vis the kinds of strategies and techniques that they use for healing and for developing ways to meet those challenges of life. So I have that one. There's another one that I'm doing, working on a project with a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been interested in photographing rock art for many, many, many years. And he's now begun to use some state-of-the-art methods to retrieve different elements of the images that have never been seen before. So it's sort of a revolutionary way of sort of looking at rock art. So I'm dealing with him. So those are two of the books that I have as well. I was offered a grant to help me finish up this other book, the one I mentioned first, because the author of that book, who I've worked with for 4 years, unfortunately passed away just a couple of weeks ago. And Jeez. So I'm left with a 100,000 word manuscript that I need to work on. So I believe that I'm going to be blessed with sufficient funding to complete that. That's part of what I do professionally, which I think is a little bit unusual, is that I offer myself as a co-author, coach, consultant, and help individuals who would like to publish either scientific articles or full-length books. And through that means, we then work together and produce a polished scientific professional publication that typically is lauded and either given special awards for their excellence. Yeah. So that's one of the most interesting things I think I'm up to these days. Have you run across anybody like that doing things like I do?
not with that variety, not usually. So no, that's pretty cool. I like it. Yeah. Plus a podcast.
Yeah. And the podcast has been a fabulous engine for increasing my notoriety, recognizing my expertise. And lately we've been pulling in people from all over the world who are experts in different forms of rock art study and archaeology, anthropology, and Native American studies. And it's been remarkable. It's really ushered in, I think, most recently, sort of the caliber and character of what I'm doing has ratcheted up considerably.
Yeah, I agree. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I think possibly with that, then this has been a great show. We are probably back to our normal recording schedule. I came on because we're not going to be able to record while I'm over in England for the month of March, but this kind of gets us a little bit caught up. So we've got some great interviews planned. And, you know, if you want to be interviewed, just reach out. Alan's contact info is in the show notes, or you can contact our producer at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, and she will be happy to connect you. So any final thoughts, Alan?
No, I think that's it. Yeah. God bless everyone who's interested in rock art and Native American studies. And I think it's an important subject, one that is part of my ministry, as I call it, because I try to help Native Americans in many different ways, but providing them recognition and opportunities to participate in this adventure we call anthropology and archaeology.
Indeed. All right. Well, with that, thanks a lot, and we will see you guys next time.
God bless everybody. See you on the flip-flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.